Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm really glad you're all here today. I have some guests who have never been to Clouds before, so I'm super happy to see them here, some friends of mine from my other life, which I might talk about a little bit today. Other life, whatever that might mean. But it kind of feels that way sometimes, so we'll see. In fact, I am going to be telling, I think people call it, we call it here a way-seeking talk, is that the term for this? A few people asked me if I would give a talk about my story, how I ended up here doing this. So I've avoided it for a few times now, but I finally agreed that maybe it's a good idea. I didn't find my own story all that interesting, but but maybe you all will. So I'll start by saying that like when I say other life, it's kind of interesting. I feel like I have three related parallel things happening in my life. One of them is my Zen practice, Buddhist practice, being here at Clouds and with my teacher at Sanshinji and at Rumonji and other places I'm doing that. The second piece of it is my career as a musician and as a teacher, which occupies a lot of my energy and historically has been really central in my life. And then also my family, my wife and my two kids, and our dog. I shouldn't leave the dog out. So they're all three are super important. And one of the things I'm going to talk about today is the huge challenge I feel of balancing those three things and giving them all the respect and energy that they need for them to thrive and for me to thrive. So I'm going to focus on Zen practice, so hopefully that'll be interesting. I started practicing Zen at MZMC in 1994. I got there through somebody who I think most people here are familiar with, this a colleague and mentor of mine named Mark Anderson. He's also a musician, and we had played together. And I had sort of been circling around Buddhism and kind of interested in one day. I asked Mark if he would recommend a book that I could read. He suggested that I should read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which was a great suggestion. And I read it, and I began sitting on my own, just sort of following what Suzuki Roshi had written in that book and trying to figure it out that way. And eventually, I was living in Uptown, so I didn't have that much excuse not to go over to MZMC at some point. So I did, and I had Zazen instruction from Michael O'Neill, who probably everybody knows also, and then went downstairs. I was up on the third floor in those days, maybe it still is, and then went downstairs to hear the talk that was given by Shohaku Okamura. And he was talking about the Heart Sutra. So I didn't understand anything he was talking about. My wife said maybe I should talk about the Heart Sutra sometime. Maybe I will. If those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's a very, very short piece of text that is incredibly dense and difficult to sort through as how it relates to Buddhism. But it's central. We chant it every morning here at Clouds and Water, and in fact, every Zen temple in the entire world chants the Heart Sutra every morning. So it's pretty important. So Shohaku was talking about the Heart Sutra, and wow, I really didn't understand, but it was really interesting. I was really interested in what he was saying, and then I was super interested in the chant that happened after the talk, which we're going to do after I'm done today. We chant the four bodhisattva vows, which are basically sort of like four propositions. We set up a proposition and then say we're going to, in a sort of impossible thing, and then vow that we're going to do it. We do it four times, you'll see. And growing up in the Lutheran church with my family, I had no preparation for this, a room full of normal-looking Minnesotans vowing to do impossible things. That was sort of the first hook for me. I was like, wow, this is not this is not not what it seems on the surface. You know, there's more. There's something I want to dig into here. So I started showing up at MZMC quite a lot, and studying what Zazen practice was. Like, what is this practice to sit here on the cushion and be quiet? And I want to talk about what I learned back then and what I think about it now. And I had, that's what I wanted to do. And then I want to say this, in the car on the way over here this morning, there was a piece on the radio, on the BBC. I want to hear the rest of it. Everyone, if you're interested, you have to find BBC, I think. It was a psychologist who studies terrorists. And they're interested in knowing how, the psychologists are very, very interested for obvious reasons in knowing how somebody decides that that's something that they can do. And what the psychologist was saying is people revise their opinions of themselves on a regular basis. We have, you know, the things that we did in the past or our motivations for what we did are constantly changing. You know, though this person has done sort of longitudinal studies of people who were involved in terrorist activities, I guess. I don't know how you do that. But the thing that she found was that their answers about what their motivations were changed over the course of her time. And those same people, when they were interviewed by other psychologists, gave totally different answers. So I thought that was sort of interesting, thinking about me trying to explain why I did what I did. It's not terrorism. But anyway, so it sort of made me rethink this process a little bit. I brought a little bit of show and tell stuff with me because I when I was doing this last night, going through some stuff, I found these two notebooks, which are both from, these are notebooks from 1995 of my notes from Shohaku's talks. And so I was really interesting to look in there and see a couple things. And I found some things I had written down that he had said that really I'd forgotten about, but really changed my life. And I brought these two books. Maybe you guys are familiar with these books. Opening the Hand of Thought by Koshu Uchiyama and The Zen Teaching of Homeless Kodo also by Uchiyama Roshi, actually. These two books were sort of my... They still are. These books were super central to me, so I want to talk a little bit. Oh, and this book. It was out of print, so I photocopied it back then, like 1994, 95, and I still have it. this book is called Shikantaza, and Shohaku made it and has a bunch of translations of texts in it. And, excuse me. So, talking about Zazen. If people don't know, the word Zazen is a compound word in Japanese. It means sitting meditation. Za means sitting, and Zen means meditation. And when we talk about Zazen in this tradition, we're typically talking about, in this tradition, we're talking about Zazen as taught by Dogen, who was the medieval 13th century Japanese founder of this tradition, carried it, went to China and brought this tradition back to Japan. And Dogen called his practice in Japanese, he called it Shikantaza, which means that za is the same sitting, and shikan means only or just. So his idea about Zazen practice was he called it just sitting. And in fact, sometimes he just called it sitting. He rarely referred to it as anything other than just sitting here. And my understanding, and maybe I give short talk about Zazen practice here. Normally, in our day-to-day lives, we find our own thinking very interesting and very important, and rightfully so, because I'm not sure what other criteria you can use for getting through the day. But also, our own thinking can cause problems. Our thinking is based on our preferences. We do a sort of habitual, instinctual, reflexive thing, where we sort things into categories, things we like, and things we don't like. And also there's a category of things we don't care about, but we don't really notice those things. And we spend our time and our energy trying to get the things we want, things we like, and trying to make the things we don't like go away. Which is fine on the one hand because I'm not sure what the other option is. Except there is another option. The reason why I think it's not entirely fine is because there's no stability in that kind of life. There's no peacefulness. If you spend all your energies devoted chasing to get the things you want and to make the things you don't want go away, you never rest. You can never, there's no peace and there's no stability. There's no foundation to that. And I think that's what Zazen practice is about for me. Is touching some kind of stability, touching some kind of peace. So when we sit here like this, a few things happen. One thing is, I don't do what I want. Does it make sense? Like if I'm bored and I want to leave, I don't do it. If I'm sleepy, I don't go to sleep. If I find some thought really, really interesting, I don't follow it. That is radical. I think it's really radical that we take on purpose some time to choose to not do, to not fulfill our desires. That's one piece of what's happening. Another piece, and I think this is really crucial. This has to do with our thinking. I want to read. This is a quote from Suwaki Roshi from one of these books. He said, a thought is nothing but a made-up story. Buddha Dharma is everything before made-up stories. Indulge me for a second. A couple more things. Uchiyama Roshi says, this is all about Zazen. Uchiyama Roshi said, in short, doing Zazen is to stop doing anything, to face the wall, and to sit, just being yourself, that is only the self. And there's an important thing that happens here in the way it's written that I can't convey in my speaking. Yourself is not capitalized. That last word, self, is capitalized. That word self is a translation of the Japanese word jiko, which we translate as self, but it doesn't mean my psychological self. It means, okay, a poem about what self is. It means this. This is Uchiyama Roshi's poem about self. Or jiko is the word he uses. He says, that which comes before boiling it up or frying it up by thought, that which precedes any processing by thought, the very quick of life, that is jiko. So when we talk about self here, I'm not talking about the self that's wondering about lunch or the self that's concerned about distinction between me and you. But it's before all of that. This is really, really hard to talk about, right? Because language comes after this, right? I think I divide things up, I put things into categories, and then I use some words to talk about it. So it's very, very difficult to try to put that back together. In fact, I think this is a really important point. It's often we have the idea that we put we divide things up, and then when we do Zazen, we can put it back together. But actually, things don't go back together once we divide things up. So it's really about letting go. It's really about letting go of that process and sitting here quietly. This is a little bit of a chaotic explanation of my idea about Zazen, but I think my thinking about Zazen is a little bit chaotic, so I'm not sure how else to do it. Because it's really, really hard to think about and really hard to talk about because it's not dependent on my thinking. In fact, often when I give people Zazen instruction, when we sit together for a little while, and then when we're done, I say something like, how's everybody doing? How is that? And they say, oh, I had a really hard time not thinking. And I find it fascinating when people say that to me, because I never in my Zazen instruction have ever suggested that you should stop thinking. But people have the idea they want to stop. They really want to stop thinking because we exhaust ourselves with our thinking, right? We totally exhaust ourselves by running around in circles with thinking. But And this is a really subtle. This is a really subtle thing. It doesn't matter whether you're thinking or not. It doesn't like your brain is running. Your brain does this. It makes thoughts. Ujamaa Roshi says your brain secretes thoughts, just like your stomach secretes gastric acid or whatever. That's its job, right? It secretes thoughts. If it stops secreting thoughts, you're dead. So we don't want to do that. But no, it's good. But we do want to change our relationship to those thoughts, which means Shohaku often talks about putting the car in neutral. The engine's still running, but the car's in neutral. It doesn't go anywhere. And that's, I think, a really good metaphor for our thinking in Zazen. So that's when I was 23 years old when I was beginning to read these books and ran into Shohaku. And it pretty much changed the way I saw the world, very much changed the way I saw the world. And I really and I decided I wanted to make this pretty central in my life. I took Jukai, the precepts, shortly thereafter, I think the next year. And then I went to Hokyoji for Ango. I was there for 2 months in the summer of 1995, which was another really life-changing experience because Shohaku was there. Shokan Weinkauf was there, who became a really, really important teacher for me. I don't know if you all know Shokan. And there were a couple monks from Japan there also. We all lived together at Hokyoji for those 2 months. And as a very young person, it was extremely influential. In fact, for years, it's kind of stopped now. For years, I dreamt incessantly about getting back there. I had all these dreams about trying to get there, and I wouldn't end up there. I would end up in some other place, you know, and like, Hokyoji was over there somehow, and I would try to get there. I never could get there. I had these dreams for years and years. So I found these notebooks. This was really cool for me to look at. I found these are notebooks. One of them, this one I think is from that Ango, from the lectures at that Ango, and I'd written down a lot of things in here. I don't know. One thing that was really interesting to me to look at these is my handwriting. I was trying to be somebody. I was trying to. I can see in my handwriting. I was trying to figure out who I was. It's really, really interesting. And if you can look at it, if you want, you can see. Like, I have terrible handwriting. Anybody who's seen my handwriting knows it's awful. And I've totally given over to that. It's not a problem for me anymore. But I was really trying in these notebooks. Like, I was really trying to adopt a style of hand. Like, I was trying to, you know what I mean? Like, I was writing slowly and neatly, and like I can see it, like me trying to become something, which is kind of an interesting thing. I found it fascinating. Anyway, like going through the sort of spiritual transformation, sort of, and my handwriting was changing day to day because I was trying to figure out how I can use my handwriting to be the person I want to be. No, it's true, which was like part of what was happening there was like I was trying to figure out there was somebody I wanted to be, and I didn't know who it was, but that person had neat handwriting, I can tell you that. And sadly, I don't have any handwriting. I should look at the clock. Okay, what time am I supposed to stop? Okay, great. So... Shohaku Okamura is the teacher who's been with me. I've followed him since that first time at MZMC, and he was there as the teacher at Hokyoji for those 2 months. He gave lectures every morning, talking about a text by Dogen called the Chiji Shingi, which is a super interesting text. It's the regulations for temple officers, which sounds really scintillating, I'm sure. but actually, it's really, really interesting because what Dogen did to make his rules for how temple officers should be is it's all stories. It's all stories about ancient temple officers, sort of like setting up how you should, you know, you want to know how to be Tenzo, here's how you be Tenzo, check out this story about so-and-so. So it's actually a really interesting text. That was cool. But as I looked through my notes, I found several, I assume they're quotes from Shohaku. They're scribbled as fast as I could, trying to be neat. To get down, and I'd like to share a couple of these things with you because I had forgotten all about this stuff until I looked at it last night. But when I read them, I realized how much impact some of these things I wrote down had on me. And I think they're really beautiful. So I'm going to read them to you. The first one, he said, as long as we live based on desire, we can never escape the meaningless cycle of samsara. Does everybody know samsara? Does everybody know what samsara means? Maybe? No. Samsara means transmigration between transmigration between the six realms of existence. So like the original idea of it is when you die, you're reborn. If you're in samsara, when you die, you're reborn into another realm. Like the realms are human realm where we are, the god realm, the fighting spirits, the hungry ghosts, help me out here. What? Animal realm and the hell dwellers. And the traditional idea is that when you die, you get reborn into one of those realms. But what Shohaku here is talking about is our moment-to-moment transmigration in those realms. Moment-to-moment, we are human beings or gods or animals or hungry ghosts. Okay. So, as long as we live based on desire, we can never escape the meaningless cycle of samsara. We must turn over the very basis of our lives, arouse bodhi mind. Bodhi mind means aspiration, the aspiration to practice, and base our lives on our life force, not desire. Before we can do this, we must reach a point where we are completely lost, where we are terrified. In order to change the basis of life, we must really see the meaninglessness of our desires. We should die and grow again based on our life force. So, the next one, he said, the relationship between teacher and student, the student must not rely on the teacher. The student should not expect anything from the teacher except his or her way of practicing, their way of life. The student may try to follow the teacher's direction, but they must go with their own legs. And the final one, he was talking about the relationship between absolute wisdom and our everyday discriminating wisdom. Oh boy, how am I going to set that up? I'm not going to, I'll just read it. Okay. He said, we're part of reality, so we cannot see it in the absolute sense. When we practice zazen, we don't discriminate. Discrimination is there, but we don't discriminate. Thought is there, but we don't think. Wisdom and reality are zazen. Absolute wisdom, or reality beyond discrimination, is actualized in zazen. Zazen is Manjushri. Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom. Usually in Zendo, Manjushri is on the altar, and Manjushri is very often portrayed sitting on the back of a lion, a tiger or a lion? A lion. The back of a lion with a sword. And that's the bodhisattva of wisdom. That sword, Manjushri uses that sword to cut off delusion. I think that's pretty interesting. So anyway, he says zazen is Manjushri, sitting practice. I almost started crying when I read that first one. Anyway, I don't know why, but it was, I think it's really, I want to talk about that for a second, where he said, we must reach a point where we're completely lost, where we're terrified. He talks about that a lot. He talks about that in his life, where, I don't know, his biography is pretty interesting, and he lived in the United States from 1975 to 1980. He came here with two other monks. They built a place in Massachusetts. They built it. They had a piece of land. It was only trees. They cut down the trees. They pulled up the stumps by themselves. They pulled up the roots by themselves, these three guys. They had no money, so to make money, they would like pick blueberries or work in a tofu factory. Shohaku worked as the night janitor in a tofu factory. To get there, he had to hitchhike. It took him like 6 hours to hitchhike there. So he would get there, he would clean the place overnight, and then he would sleep there because he can't hitchhike back in the middle of the night, and then hitchhike And then once in the morning, he would come back. So it was a very, and then come back and they would pull tree stumps or, you know, and build building, whatever they did. I tell that story to say what happened was, he says, I broke my body. And he couldn't do anything anymore. He had to go back to Japan. He had no health insurance or anything here. And he had nothing to do in Japan, so he went back there. He went back to Japan, but he had no health care there either and no money. And that was when he talked, I think when he talks about this, becoming completely lost and terrified, he's talking about that time when he was completely by himself with no money and no one to practice with, and in fact he couldn't practice because his back, he couldn't sit. And he talks about that as a really important transition point in his life because he began to sit again. And he says, I was sat for no reason. You know, before that maybe there's sometimes you all know this, there can be some ego gratification in our practice, right? Like, I'm doing a good job. I got up early in the morning and I sat, you know, or like, whatever. You know, we can use anything we want to sort of, we can use anything we want to gratify our egos. But Shohaku was saying at that point he had no reason to sit anymore. Nobody cared. There was nobody around, and yet he started to sit and practice zazen. And he said at that point he felt like he was really practicing for the first time, even though he'd been practicing for many years. Because he had nothing to prove with it anymore, and no one to impress, or no reason to do it at all. So, and it's just based on life force. So I think that's what he means there. Two other things about that time at Hokyoji, and then I want to talk about what happened afterwards. There were these Japanese monks there. They were awesome. They were so much fun. We had a great time. And they kept telling me that I should become a priest. And so I talked to Shohaku about it at that time. I said, you know, Taiken and Seishi said you should ordain me. What do you think? And he said, this is funny because he's Japanese. He said, they're Japanese guys. They don't know what else to tell you. No, he was like, if you're interested in zazen, they don't have any other thing to say other than like you should become a priest. He said you don't have to become a priest. There's no reason. If you want to, you can, but you don't have to do that. So I was like, oh cool, I'm not going to do that right now. but it planted the idea in my head that never went away. After that, I moved back up here to the Twin Cities, and I completely fell apart. After that time there, and even when I was there, things were getting a little rough sometimes, you know. And I was talking to Shohaku and Shoken about it, and nobody could help me because it was just me. But spending that time really set me up in a way. It set me up to fall apart. It was inevitable, you know. I had suffered. I'd struggled with depression and stuff since I was a kid, and when I got back from Hokyoji, it was grim, grim, grim. And I had hoped at that time. I'd hoped that, like, Zen practice was an antidote to that, and in a way, it is. It can be. It can be, but, you know, I only tell that to say that we have to take care of ourselves, you know, because doing this kind of practice can be really, really intense. And if you have, like I did, have trauma from your childhood, that can become a real thing, a real problem. And I know there are people in this room who are dealing with stuff like that for sure. And I'm still dealing with it now. And practice has been really important, a really important way of handling that. But, you know, having trained people to talk to about it has also been a really helpful way to deal with that. It became a sort of a dark time for me, that dealing with depression, and then Shohaku left. His time at MZMC was up. And MZMC closed Hokyoji. And those three things were really, that was like, I didn't really know. So I left MZMC. I didn't have anything to do with, not angry, just it wasn't a place for me there anymore. And simultaneously, things in my music career were changing a lot, and that sort of took over. Two things happened. I had a brush with rock stardom, which was fun and really cool. That happened for a little while. I stopped doing that, and I had the opportunity to move to France to study double bass with a teacher in France, who became the next really super important person teacher in my life. So my family, I'll tell you this. This is a good story. So he's in the double bass world. This guy is as famous as you get. His name is Francois Rabat. He's incredible person. And he was legendary to me, but somebody gave me his phone number and said, oh, you should call him. You could go there and study with him. So finally, I had the number for months. Finally, I called him one day. And this guy, Paul, had said I should come study with him. I told him that, and he said, oh, if Paul said you should come, then you should come. I said, okay, I'll try. I'm not making this up. I said, okay, I'll try. And he said, don't try, do it. And so I hung up the phone and I called my wife. Eli was 2 years old. I called my wife and I said, Francois Rabat says I should come to Paris. She said, okay. So we sold our house and we packed up our 2-year-old son and our dogs and we moved to France. And I lived there. I studied with Francois. And Francois is an amazing bass teacher. But I bring him up because actually he became my next really important spiritual teacher. Francois has all these little sayings. Just do it is one of them. Like he has no tolerance for trying. It's true. No, and in my lessons, he would offer. I'd be playing play something for him, and he would stop me. And he would say, "Why? Why are you trying?" And I would be like, "What do you mean?" It's like, I can't tell this story. Okay, but he would say, "Man, if you try, you try your whole life." That's pretty interesting. If you try, you try your whole life. You never do anything. You just try. Actually, Dogen says the same thing in Genjo Koan, but I won't get into it right now. And he always talks about not comparing yourself with other people. He says, never compete with other people. He says, be better than yourself. Be better than yourself. Every day, grow up a little bit. Wow, this guy's a Zen teacher. It's pretty interesting. Grow up a little bit every day. Become an adult. So I studied, had the chance, up till now I still am working with Francois, but that was really transformative to spend that intense time living in Paris and working with Francois, and then we moved back here. And I had to figure out how to practice. I was very intense about my music career at that time, and I could never do sesshin when any of the four Zen centers had their sesshins. But I really wanted to be doing that, so I started doing sesshins every month. I was actually in Lower Town, like pretty much across the street from Clouds. I was doing sesshin by myself every month because I could never go to the Clouds or any of the other ones. And I did sesshin in the style that we do it in our tradition, which is a little bit different. I'm just going to say a couple things about that, and then I'm going to finish up and ask, see if anybody has a question or two. When we sit for sesshin, it's like zazen. The style of the sesshin is like the style of zazen. In other words, we don't do anything except for sit. We don't have any service. We don't have no chanting, no lectures, no work period. Just sitting. And it's super intense and amazing. A totally different kind of experience because it's like really like a 1 day or 2 or 3 or 5 day period of zazen because there's nothing else to do. And doing that practice by myself and at San Shinji has been super intense. And I'm happy to say that we're going to have a sesshin like that here in August. Kyoku and I are going to lead it. And I encourage you to come. Just a quick plug. I encourage you to come. You can come for as much. Please, if you can come for the whole session, great. But if you just come sit, want to come sit a few periods with us, two or three periods, one period, that's welcome too. But it is a different kind of different style thing, and I think if you're interested in practice, you would find it enjoyable. I don't know. Something. You would find it something. You would find something there. So at this point, I was reconnecting with Shahak, who is now in Bloomington, Indiana. We recommenced our conversation about me becoming a priest, which happened in 2013. I was ordained, and I've been continuing to work with him, and very happily have sort of made my way into the community here at Clouds over the last few years. And if you don't know, one of the main things I'm doing here is leading the high school group, which is super cool. It's super cool. I have a couple of my really cool high schoolers here right now. And today we're going with GD to Fort Snelling for a Bearing Witness retreat. There was a concentration camp there for Native Americans that we're going to go and do something. But I can't get into it. I'm sorry. So I'm doing that and trying to sort out how in the world you be a Zen priest, a musician and teacher, and have a family. I don't know how to do it, honestly, but I'm trying. So that's the end of my talk. If anybody has a comment or question, that would be great. Or we can finish up. Yes, Lillian.
Well, I think your talk is very interesting.
Thank you.
I hope that you can do it again and do a full hour, because there's a lot of meat there. So don't sell yourself short on that. Okay. And very inspiring about peeling the onion, peeling the layers of sitting. That it takes, I believe, it takes years. I feel like every time I sit, I'm always relearning or having to learn to go one level below. It's not simple to get. I can't even put into words. But I thought you approached that, and I really appreciate what you had to say.
Thanks, Leonard.
Could you explain the difference between doing and trying? I always, when I get to that quote, it's Yoda or if there's no, I understand it on some level, but what's the difference?
I think there's something subtle there in the character of doing it in a way where you're manifesting something true about yourself, or trying to do it well. Do you know what I mean? And I think trying to do it well it inhibits that. Like, if you have my handwriting, right? It's so, you look, if I show you, you'll see it's so stilted and strange, this writing. Even though my current writing is ugly, it looks real. This looks fake. No, it does. You know what I mean? And so I think there's something to it. It's like, if you ever get to watch my friend Christopher sitting back there play the drums, you'll see what I'm talking about. When Christopher plays the drums, he's not trying. He's doing it. And, it's really about manifesting something about yourself, I think, and not trying to be something. Or, you know what I mean? I don't know if that's helpful, but for me, it's that, I think.
Just on that subject, when you, at the end of your talk, you said, I don't know how I can juggle these three things, but I'm trying.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Glenna.
So, here's a confession. I've always been jealous of musicians, because it seems to me they have access to Zazen faster than anybody else.
Hmm.
And I've wondered about this. It's because maybe because music is pretty verbal or non-verbal.
Mm-hmm.
And that ability. So I wanted you to talk a little.
Mm-hmm.
Is it very similar? What's the similarity? What's the difference?
I think it's similar. It can be similar. For many, many years, my primary thing that I've done as a musician is I'm an improviser. Uh-huh. And my main partner is sitting right there. And we've never discussed it, actually. We've never talked about improvising together. We've probably played 500 concerts together. I don't know. We've never said a word to each other about what we were going to do.
Do you deliberately not talk about it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but what would we talk about? But the reason I bring it up is to say this, like, it is pre-verbal. It's doing, not trying, I guess, and it's also there's a huge word that I never mentioned today, but this is a huge word, trust. There's an element of trust and faith, actually. Faith is a word that we get really squeamish about, you know? It's a difficult one, but like, what?
You do it and you don't try.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you let go of that, and you let go of needing a particular result. Right? If you're coming to Zazen with the idea of a particular result, you might get it. But I'm not sure it's Zazen, and that's okay. Like, you know, if your idea for taking up meditation practice is to lower your blood pressure or relieve stress or whatever, bless you, that's fantastic, and I hope that it helps. No, honestly, I have no problem with that. That's fantastic. But it's a different practice than what I'm talking about here. This is more of a sort of existential thing to do with your consciousness and your relationship to the universe, whatever, right? And if you're coming to that, saying to yourself, I'm going to figure out something about what my relationship to the universe is, and I'm going to do it right now, I'm going to sit down and do it, and I'm going to really try, I think it's not going to work. Anyway, yeah.
I think that you're also probably not, if you've never played the piano before, go play the concerto. So you have a practice period to be a musician for years and years and years.
Right.
Learning form and content,
right,
and all of these things, and
right,
to let go of. And it's
right,
a natural way of becoming to
right,
live in form and practice. And same thing in Zazen or in life itself is you have to become someone before you can become nobody, in the words of a famous teacher.
Yeah.
But it's frustrating to sit when you first begin to sit in meditation and go, why can't I get this? Why can't I be a concert pianist now?
Right.
You can't. It's a journey. It's an evolving. And there's no place to get to.
Right. And it's an important point is, no matter how many years you've been practicing Zazen, your Zazen is not different from somebody who practiced for the first time. Context changes, experience changes, all that stuff, but actually sitting down and sitting there and letting go of thoughts is not different because you've done it before, I think. Yeah.
So maybe the difference is the impact that has in your life when you have done it for a while.
I think so.
It's the difference is very subtle. Like, I used to react, and now I think before I react. There is, like, more control.
I think so, yeah.
So, but it takes years to develop that. And I'm not saying that I have it, but
No.
That I can catch my thoughts when I didn't before. So it makes a difference.
For sure. I think there's a cumulative effect in your life over years, but I don't think it changes your sitting practice. I think. I don't know. That's an interesting distinction, but you're right, I think, yeah. Yeah.
I was back to try. When I think of try, I think you have two paths with try. You succeed, you fail. Whereas do, you are there.
You did it.
You're not focusing on this or that. You're there.
Right. Focus on result. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
That's a great distinction. Yeah. Anybody else? Sarah?
I am a dance instructor, as you know, a dance professor, and I've just come off of teaching a session of dance improvisation to my students. You know, we work on dance technique, and then we've been exploring dance improvisation, and I've been thinking about being a performer, and, you know what's, so I've performed improvisationally as well as choreography, but how do you teach someone to perform? And I kept telling my students, if you can bring this feeling of improvisation to your set choreography, you know what's coming next, but you can bring the sense that you're improvising to your set ritual of, then that's a way to become an engaging performer. So I'm sitting here thinking a lot about just our daily rituals and what we do and how we go through it, and I don't know, how do we have that sense of improvisation when you were talking about your improvisational music, and we've collaborated before as composer, and there's always been a connection there for me with Brian as far as our process, and I'm wondering if, I don't know if I'm rambling a little bit, but I'm just wondering about that sense of immediacy. Even though you know exactly what the plan is and what's coming on, how do you experience and investigate each moment?
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking when you're talking just about how we approach our day-to-day lives, which sometimes might seem like, sometimes it seems boring, like you do, maybe some people have the same thing they do every day. But what if you approach it like that? What if you approach it like, I don't know what's going to happen. What if you approach it like, what happens when I get up and brush my teeth this morning? What happens next?
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, maybe that's one way of being more engaged with your life and having more of a sense of sort of wonder and practice, actually, in that you're carrying off of sitting here on the cushion, but into going to teach at the school or, you know, answer your emails or whatever you need to do. Maybe. Yeah. Thank you.
Closing chant is on.